If you'd asked me at the beginning of the year, I might look at how the government's opening up data, how the Open Government Initiative has encouraged the agencies to both share information with themselves, to work more with the American people. I might have looked at how that is actually spreading around the country in terms of open data initiatives. If you asked me in the middle of the year, I might have looked at the different ways, again, those local governments are starting to use a lot of the capacity to talk with citizens through these new channels. And if you'd asked me a couple weeks ago, I'm afraid I might have to say it's the impact of WikiLeaks and all this.
Yeah.
I mean, there's just no way around it. We just heard that the Navy CIO looks like he's going to stop blogging. And, of course, you know, the Air Force is warning its airmen not to log on or have seemed to maybe even have blocked the times. I mean, there's a major a reversal in course in a lot of ways. And if we parse through the stories, there's an awful lot of very good ones in terms of the more effective use of technology by government. And I think we could go down the list, but it has to be balanced with how that technology is also a neutral tool and that the ways that the different constituencies, both in this country and abroad, can also use it in ways that may not serve the national interest. So we have to take a more balanced look at what's actually happening.
My take on the WikiLeaks is it seems like a lot of what's going on, blocking access to the New York Times, for goodness sakes, is a little bit knee-jerk reaction. Like, we're so panicked that now we're going to stop. I mean, what are we going to do next? Not allow people to talk to one another because they may talk about something they saw in the WikiLeaks? I mean, it's just, it seems like it's almost gone from the sublime to the ridiculous.
There's some challenges in terms of thinking through how this all impacts life in a new media world,
yeah.
Right? When we have the internet, there would be some real challenges in telling servicemen or anyone else not to talk with one another about something. Restricting access to media is something all I think another level in terms of thinking through how this sort of thing is going to go forward. And I think it goes to the sort of essential question about what happens when something enters the public domain. Do all citizens in government, outside of government, then have the right to access it, to talk about it, to share it, and in what context? And those questions are still evolving. I mean, we're in a day when people are talking a lot about the fact that Mark Zuckerberg is Times, man of the year, person of the year, I should say, and what that means. And even though people are critical of that, mostly because they're thinking that Julian Assange should be, in terms of the effect he's had in the last month, the greater context for that choice is that Facebook and the internet in general has created unbelievable amounts of disruption in terms of our relationships to one another and our relationships to government. And I think if we wanted to, I really latch on to a big story for the year, it's that we're still learning about how disruptive that's going to be in all the different ways that it impacts our lives, the way we work, the way we play, the way that we conduct our government, the way our government can conduct its business. I mean, there's all these, people say, emergent effects. When you create these platforms, you don't always know exactly what's going to be generated from people collaborating and communicating on them. And unfortunately, it's not always going to be positive. Anyone who's a cyber utopian, as they say, is probably going to get knocked down a couple pegs if they think it's all, gingerbread cookies and Santa Claus.
Yeah, we just talked to Earl Devaney of the Recovery Board, and one of my favorite quotes of the year comes from him, and he said, if you're into transparency at all, you be prepared to be embarrassed at some point. Out of transparency, yeah. Out of openness, comes a certain level of embarrassment. Now, my hope is that we learn to actually accept that people are people, and guess what? People make mistakes. And that we actually acknowledge those mistakes, and sometimes that stuff happens. So, yeah, you may have a WikiLeaks kind of event that happens, but the world doesn't come to an end, and it just seems to me like the reaction has been just almost an overreaction. Like, okay, we're not sharing information at all, and that seems not to be the lesson that we've learned.
I think that's a really solid analysis, and that's why I tune in to Federal News Radio, because you're really thinking about this stuff and talking to more people in government than almost anyone I know. I think that the comment that the need to share versus need to know dynamic has shifted again is very important in terms of thinking through what we learned from, well, unfortunately, 9/11,
yeah,
you know, 9 years ago, that a lot of the redundancies that exist within the intelligence community, a lot of the stovepipes, the silos, the rest of the things that are an issue for government, to government communications, are still there. And one of the best parts of Gov2O, or open government, or any of the kind of new ways of using technology is that in theory, they can help government be more efficient in information sharing, not just with the public, but with one another.
Yeah.
So if you look at how open data in states has actually gone forward and talked to the people who are running these data stores, they're saying, hey, listen, our search logs are showing that people are looking for the data internally too. It's not just citizens or developers or private industry, but our internal customers are using these things too, because it's a place where they can easily access information. And that's something I think is essential to take forward, that you don't, as they say, throw out the baby with the bathwater, that the all of the efficiencies and productivity possibilities, all of the kinds of opportunities that exist through the more effective use of lightweight information technology, you know, that shouldn't be something that they turn the clock back on just because we've got an issue with a private who posted a lot of data and there weren't appropriate controls to detect that. I mean, I think that's one of the other lessons just to consider in terms of a basic concern here, is that it appears that the State Department has shut off access to the CIPRNet. And that means that there's a lot of people who may not have more access to what's on that network. Now, I understand there's a legitimate security concern in terms of exposing information to inappropriate parties, but that's something that can be architected in terms of the network and appropriate controls, authentication, all the different things that new security technologies do offer some opportunities around. And it's also a reminder that your weakest point in the network is often people.
Yeah.
You know,
and it's not always external. It can be just, you have to think about internal as well.
Yeah. The before I began reporting upon this, I was a regulatory compliance reporter. And I talked to a lot of security officers, compliance officers in private industry.
Those are party people, aren't they?
they can be fun sometimes, but their day-to-day is not. It's dry, but incredibly important in terms of delivering upon the laws and regulations that they have to deal with, and understanding the technical limitations. And a lot of times, also getting beyond simple compliance, right? Understanding just because you've checked the boxes of something, you're not actually secure. Just because you put in these controls doesn't mean that the actual privacy considerations are fully addressed. And I think that the insider threat is one that corporate America has been very concerned about since the financial crisis began 2 years ago, because there's more pressure upon people to take something with them if something bad happens. And I think that the fallout from that is probably still evolving.
The regulatory and compliance holiday parties. I mean, my goodness, people, just lamps on the heads and just all sorts of mayhem. Let me ask you one question, because you brought it up. It two things that struck me out of the whole OpenGov and Gov 2.0 and all that is, number one, it's how you define this stuff. And I think the measure in the end has to be, does it help government do its job better? Otherwise, it becomes part of the fun to have rather than must have.
Yep.
And also the aspect of, as you said, it seems to me the real power from open government comes from the intra-agency sharing. And people within EPA being able to have access to stuff that the Energy Department has that they've never been able to tap before. And the incredible things that can come from that kind of sharing. And it's almost gone below the radar.
Well, it's not a sexy story.
Right.
I mean, this is not something that, for better or worse, you're going to see in the major news magazines or that CNN is going to pick up. It's not something that's going to attract a ton of online traffic in the way that the newest shiny object from Apple or juicy tidbit from Google or Twitter or Facebook or any of the other things that drive traffic to the major blogs do. And it's not, unless there's an embarrassment angle, it doesn't tend to be something that gets a lot of political coverage either, right? These are nuts and bolts governance sorts of issues. It's the sort of stuff that policy wonks are into and that people who work a long time in government care about, but that the American people often, for whatever reason, whether it's attention span or whether they've gotten grounding in really civic education or have sort of seen connected to their daily lives, are going to necessarily be is invested in terms of comparing it to other things which they need to navigate their daily life. And I think that's where the dotted line could be connected better. That's frankly where I could be doing my job better, is looking at the sort of lessons from how major policy changes actually ramify down to individual people's lives, right? The choice to classic choice to open up GPS data. Well, it's wonderful you put the satellites into orbit, but the innovation now is that I can get a directions on my smartphone, turn-by-turn directions from a dashboard device. And there's been, you know, billion-dollar industries created from that, or that weather data provisions things. And one of the big stories from this year, as you know, is that community health data is being put out in better form from Health and Human Services. And we'll see whether baking that into different devices and different services enables people to make better health decisions and save money in the process, and whether that also converts to saving plans and other areas some money too. I mean, that in the end is when this stuff matters, is when it stops being a buzzword and it stops being something that people fight over definitions around or fight around the sort of taking the political spoils, and it's just quietly something that citizens benefit from.
Yeah.
You know, instead of having to, you know, be stuck at the DMV, being able to pull up an app or pull up a website or subscribe to an SMS service that tells me that there's a 30-minute wait time at this one and there's a 5-minute wait time at this one, and then pull up another app and says, okay, here's the nearest bus that's showing up, and pull up another one and be able to get information about the local food truck. I mean, all these sorts of things exist for people who've been digitally empowered because they know about them, because they have the ability to, you know, get an expensive data plan and a smartphone. The question is when they get democratized enough to be able to everybody, be able to be available to everybody, rather, on less expensive devices, and some of that digital divide gets pushed down.